Okay, it's June 24th, 1994, and I'm Natalie Peters here with Mr. John E. Clark. And Mr. Clark, I just want you to talk about your life in Harford County. Can we start with what brought your family to the area?
Well, I really don't know, except that my family has been here for many, many years. They early settled up what was known as Clark's Bridge area on Greer-Nursher Road. George Greer now owns one of the original homestead of the family, and my father was born just across the road from that that house, and his name was William L. Clark, and his father was William T. And William T. was a county surveyor at one time and did a lot of surveying, civil engineering. I think my father did some, but he didn't make a profession of it. My father chose farming, and his family was born on a farm on Grafton Shops Road. It's a farm that last several years has been known as Saddle Acres Farm, where my brother lived until his death some years ago, and his widow's there. Is there now. However, the farm has been sold to Klein family. There was 11 children in our family, and they was two younger than I. And actually, there's the three youngest and one of the older members of the family, our sisters, all now living. I believe she's about 95 or 6, and lives with my brother down in Salisbury. My earliest recollection, of course, was the usual, I suppose, of a farm boy that's raised on a farm. The animals. My first memory was we had dairy cows, quite a large dairy herd. And our farming was mostly raising crops for the dairy herd, and we did raise some vegetables. As a matter of fact, at that time, and that would have been before the First World War, there was a great deal of vegetables grown in Norfolk County. As a matter of fact, Harford County was the center of the tomato canning industry. It began here, I believe, somewhere in 1885 or somewhere in that area. And the first can commercially was done here in the county. And I am told that from people in the industry that the turn of the century of 1900, the more than half of all the tomatoes canned in the world was canned here in Harford County. And tomato canning factories had just blossomed up all over the county.
Were these small factories, or were they large?
Oh, they were small, very small by any proportion that you look today. However, there's one here just locally that is owned by the Jordan family, which, as far as I know, is the only canning factory operating in Harford County. And there hasn't been but two or three matter of fact, the last large one to stop canning, of course they didn't can tomatoes, was the Mitchell family in Perryman. And they stopped farming a few years ago, or stopped canning. And their crop was corn. But tomatoes was the first crop that was canned here. That was followed by string beans, and then by corn, if I recall, if my recollection is correct. Now those factories had a great deal to do with the agricultural economy of the county, because they apparently were profitable for the farmers. It took an awful lot of labor, because the crop had to be planted by hand and tilled, or you could till it with the use of cultivators, but in teams or horses. But you had to have a lot of hand labor, people pulling weeds, and you couldn't. Tomato plant is not very competitive with weeds and grasses, so that had to be removed by hand, a lot of it, because the cultivators weren't efficient enough to do it. And then the picking process, of course, they all had to be picked by hand, and that was, they were picked in baskets, and their roads were made out through the tomato fields, and then they were hauled to the factories where they were processed. And again, practically all the processing was hand done, peeling and packing and so forth. And that industry continued on until, and was very active prior to and during the First World War, because tomatoes was something that you could ship overseas as a food, because it was in a can, required no refrigeration, it just had cases of it. And I suppose it was one of the very few foods that could be handled in that way. And particularly it was a food that had any liquid or fluid to do with it. So the industry thrived, and as I say, particularly during World War, Part One. But a couple of things happened that changed the picture. One was the war was over, and that demand from the government dropped off. Secondly, the tomato industry was expanding and moving to other areas where it was much, much simpler to cultivate, such as on the eastern shore of Maryland with the sandy flat lands. And so then there was a third thing that was happening that probably was the factor that finally did the industry in, was they developed a blight that attacked the plant. Mm-hmm. And that had the effect of destroying the plant itself. And of course your crop was ruined. Now later years they developed pesticides that would handle the blight. Matter of fact, they do it. What tomatoes are grown in the area now? None in Harford County. In fact, all of them in southern Pennsylvania in the Amish country. They have to spray their tomatoes with regularly in order to control the blight. But the industry just sort of collapsed and left the agriculture situation of Harford County in a rather dire straits.
What year was this about?
This was following World War One, I'd say in the early 1920s. And so the farmers began to seek rapidly of a something to replace the tomatoes. And the industry that rather quickly took hold here was the dairy industry. Dairying was a very you might say limited in capability of delivering milk any distance from the point where it was collected, and
because there was no way to cool it, keep it fresh.
Was way to keep it cool and fresh, and pasteurization, although it was being applied to milk at that time, the processes were not that good. The time between the actual producing of the milk and from the cow to the doorstep, you know, in those days they used to deliver the milk to the household, not to the store, because the store had no way to keep it, had no way to retain it. And of course that's all changed, because today your milk supply is practically entirely, and is of course in rural areas, entirely from the store. The processing of it, the pasteurization of it, and the handling of it now gives you a very long shelf time, so to speak, to carrying, both in the home refrigerator and in the distributor. So that's changed in dramatically over the years, but in the early years, when I recall it, we milked the cows, we had a spring house, we called it, where we had a spring water, probably a temperature, probably 55 to 60 degrees. And that's where the milk was set in, that in cans, 5 and 10 gallon cans, and we had a device that you could stir the milk with right in the can, and so that as it circulated against the outside of the can, it would be cooled by the water. Very slow process. That was how it was handled. Matter of fact, there was no transportation for milk to get it to the large communities like Baltimore City, except it was developing at that point in time, and I can't really state with any accurate knowledge when the shipping of milk or the handling of milk on railroads. But the railroad was the first transportation system that was available to handle milk delivered to the cities from the outlying areas. And the Maryland-Pennsylvania Railroad, which ran from, I think, York, Pennsylvania to Delta and Forest Hill, Bynum, Bel Air, Vale was our station, Falston, and on to Baltimore. And the milk train train was a passenger train. It hauled passengers in the morning, but it also had cars that carried the milk. And each of the stations had a large platform where the cans of milk were set on to, waiting the arrival, and then they would be loaded on the train and taken to Baltimore, and milk would process, and of course and delivered to the individual homes by wagons, my first memory, and horse and wagon. So the milk industry was coming along, and at the point in time when the tomato industry and the vegetable industry, canning, was sort of, might say, fading out, and it took the place of a lot of farmland that had been in tomatoes. And I can recall during the 20s and the 30s, particularly during the 20s, the factories, the tomato factories around the communities, they would only be a couple of miles apart because you couldn't haul the tomatoes very far. You only had a farm wagon, and there was no springs on it to handle the tomatoes gently. You could only haul them a very short distance. And so you had to have the factories close together, and they were small. But those factories were, those canning factories were just, during the late 20s, you could just see the remains of them all over the county. And we had one on our farm. As a matter of fact, my family got into the canning business. And they canned for a brokerage firm. Most of the tomatoes were canned by people that didn't do any selling. They would contract their output to what was known as brokers, and those brokers then would sell that, you see, and then they would have you label the product in accordance with their directions, and it might be any kind of a brand was put on your tomatoes, you know, but it was what that broker was selling. So the tomato industry just passed out, and with really suddenly. All of it was, I say, related to disease control, technology, the industry moving where it's adapted. And when you think of it, the tomatoes, which is a food that we eat and a great deal of, that those tomatoes are grown in a relatively few sections of this country. And it is the sections that are best adapted, presumably, by climate and soils and that sort of thing, to the growth of tomatoes. And there's none on the East Coast at all, except the limited acreage in the South that for early tomatoes, and Florida, of course, has a big grow, of course, year-round in some of the South. But I don't think that the southern states, other than Florida, are really big producers of tomatoes anymore. The canning tomatoes, for instance, are all in the around the Lake States and on the West Coast.
You remember the time that your family had the canning plant?
Well, I remember it operating, yes.
And what were your responsibilities? Did you work in the canning?
No, I was not old enough to, at that point in time, to have any responsibilities. I was just sort of wandering around the operation and probably in the way, don't you know? But I never carried out any duties. Now, I used to pick tomatoes. I used to do a little of that. But that was a point in time when we were selling them as fresh tomatoes in the city. And at that point in time now, which is now again the early 20s, transportation changed. The truck came into the business as a transportation force, and it joined the railroad. Of course, it became more efficient, the railroad, because it could get right out to the farms and places, and then they could take it directly. If you sent it by railroad, you had to get it to the railroad by transportation, you see, from the farm. But when it received in Baltimore City, the dairy, or you see, the processing plant, they would have to pick that up and haul it to the dairy. Whereas the truck enabled you to pick the milk or pick the tomatoes or corn or beans or whatever it was up and haul it directly to the market. Now, there wasn't tomatoes at the time. They were the canning of tomatoes continued in Baltimore City after it did here, because they had built up a large industry that was largely related to the areas right around Baltimore City, close by, and also the Eastern Shore. And so that is sort of the tomato picture and vegetable picture.
Can you describe the canning plant that was on your farm? How big was it, and how many people worked there?
Well, I suppose it was a plant that maybe was. Maybe it was about 50 by 100 feet, I suppose. The number of people maybe were 50 that would work there when they were working.
Men and women?
Men and women, yeah. Mostly they were from Baltimore City. What you would do is to have structures, just the crudest kind of shelter for the people, and they would live there.
Mm-hmm. Housing right here, right on the property.
They would live right on the property, and they would cook, you know, in the crudest way, but they would just, see, the tomato season wouldn't last very long.
So they would sort of migrate.
They would be migrating, in this case, all just from Baltimore. But from East Baltimore area, they used to get, and then there would be there people who would develop the, sort of a business of rounding up people for you, and you contract with them to get your labor out. They would contract and say, "Well, how many do you need?" And they'd bring them out and supervise them, and kind of you wouldn't have to have that problem of Terry taking care of their individual needs and whatnot. You see, and you were kind of turning it over to them. And that's another thing that's changed immensely over the years, is the laws regarding housing and health and that sort of thing has just about put that kind of migrant labor out of business. They still try to carry it on the Eastern Shore, but they're in constant problems with the law and so forth, and it's very difficult now with the labor unions and so forth to operate any industry that requires migrant labor.
Do you recall if these people were black people or white people?
All white.
All white?
All white. They were from East Baltimore, usually from the Polish community. And that is, at least I would say that was my memory. That may have been very quite different in terms of it. It wouldn't have been local native people.
Did they bring their families, or was it just the adults?
Well, no, they come out, families and all, and then the small children pick tomatoes, you know, and pick beans and things like that. And, that's quite an interesting area, that country. But then the dairying came along, and this brought in a whole new type of thing. For instance, a lot of the land was just farmers were just sort of decided to get out of business, do something else. And as a matter of fact, it reduced the price of land in Norfolk County tremendously. And
about what year was that again?
I would say that was in the 20s. And as a matter of fact, pre-World War I, too, I'd say. But it was very, very heavy during the post-war years, and that's when we got a tremendous migration of farmers from the south. mostly from North Carolina and Southwest Virginia, and several communities in North Carolina were sort of identifiable as at that time as the areas which came up here, and then they bought the farms, and you could buy them pretty cheap, and most of them were people that came up with some resources, that is, people who bought land here, and and then what they did was to encourage people to come up and work on the land, and they would provide them housing and that sort of thing. And so that migration pattern of sort of early immigrants attracting more and so forth and helping has really continued up until fairly modern times. As a matter of fact, even for business purposes, you might say people migrated here. For instance, Beatty Shoe Company. Beatty Shoe Company is they came here and employed a lot of people from the South that were here, but they also attracted more. And they had a great many of the families from the South. And actually, if you look at the farming community today in the county, and you look at the community as a whole, business and otherwise, what you're looking at is a great many people who came here as migrated here for farm labor and some of the industries that were here. And they're the key part of our population today. And you can look at the families around us that have been tremendous contributors. Todd families, the Osbournes, and any number of them have made a tremendous contribution to the county and its economy. Well, anyway, we're getting along now. I'm through with the milk industry's now in sort of high gear, and it's the milk's all being transported by truck, and it's growing, and so that was sort of the situation when I finished high school. And
and what were your responsibilities at that time? Were you helping out
on the dairy farm? My brothers and I had two younger brothers, and we were sort of in school at the same era, and we went to school at Bel Air after the fourth grade. The first four grades were a little school at High Point. We used to walk to school about 2 miles every day, one room school, and so they, after the fourth grade, my fourth grade, they closed that school, and we went to, I can't remember whether they closed at that time, but I know we started the Bel Air, which was in the fifth grade. I can't remember whether it was the closing date that we transferred, or whether it was the closing date later than our transfer. But when we were going to school, we used to participate in athletics, all of us. All of us, I'm talking about my brothers and I. And we used to have to milk cows on the farm. We would get up about 5:30 in the morning, help milk cows for a couple hours, and then we'd have breakfast and change our clothes and dress and off to school. And at that point in time, well, first drove a horse and buggy for a couple of years.
To school?
To school and Bel Air. And then we got an old, got a Model T Ford, and of course the Ford helped us out like it did a lot of people, transportation. So we used a, we would go to school by car, and then of course when we got back we'd still have to do our milking. So if we had a baseball game or something like that, it kept us after school. Well, when we got back, whether it was dark or what, we still had those cows to milk. And after that, of course, any studying that got done, which many times was pretty little in terms of the end of the day. But that was sort of the farm picture at that time. And then graduated in high school. I wanted to go to college, and I don't know how, really. Looking back on it, I just don't know how in the world I was able to do it. I mean, bring myself to do it. When I look around me today, I don't see any young people that have anything like the kind of obstacles that I had at that time.
What kind of obstacles?
I didn't have any money. That was first. And second, I didn't have any members of my family had been in college. So I didn't know what that was all about. But I went to study agriculture. I had been in 4-H club work and on the judging team, and state judging team, and national judging team. And I liked dairy cattle, and that's what I wanted to do. Thought of it. And but in any event, I got to College Park, borrowed money to get there, and a friend of mine, as a matter of fact, a very close friend of the family at that point in time, was a principal political factor here with Senator Tidings, was Major Archer, and the major encouraged me to go to college. And he tried to get me an athletic scholarship, but I had no football experience and not quite large enough to play that sport. But in any event, and he tried to get me a scholarship. I think we did get a scholarship, I think, for my tuition. But then I had to find my board and so forth, books and so forth. So I recall sitting in the major's office one day, and I'd gone to see him about going to school. And everything was settled, except I didn't know how in the world I was going to get enough money. So he said to me, "How much money do you need to get started?" And I told him it was $400 that I need to get registered and get started. And he said, "Well, do you have any of that?" I said, "No, I don't." Well, he said, "What you going to do when you get there, and after you've spent all this money on your entry for board and so forth?" And I said, "I'll make out some way." So he said, "You think you could go to school if you had $400? And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you want to go to college bad enough to borrow the money?" I said, "Do." I said, "I don't know where I'd borrow it." So he reached in his desk and he got a note from what was then the Sick National Bank. And Wally Hopkins was the name of the president of the bank. In those days, the chief officer was the cashier. Wally was the father of Harry Hopkins, is now the Judge Orphan, or Richard Wills. And So he signed, endorsed a note, called up Mr. Hopkins, and he said, "Wiley, John Clark." He said, "Mamie's son." He said, "You know him. He plays baseball here on the team," and so forth. He said, "He wants to go to college. He wants to borrow $400. I'm sending him over there, and he has my name on the note as an endorser. Give him the money." And that's how I got to College Park. And when I got to College Park, I found a job in the dairy barn milking cows, morning and night, 35 cents an hour. And so, without burdening that point, that's how I got through college. As a matter of fact, I organized, I helped my two brothers, younger brothers, come to college. And we used to work in the dairy barns and on the farm there while we were in college. As a matter of fact, it was all the money we had. And we even had one bank account. We put all of our money, whoever anybody had, they put in that account, and we paid everybody's expenses out of it, regardless of what the ratio was to what you put in. So that was sort of college and so forth, you know. But while I was at college, I got interested in politics on the campus. And, matter of fact, I helped to organize a political club, a democratic club, and we just had a change in administration, you see, in 32, and during my time there, and Roosevelt was elected as president, and I became a great admirer of him, and our democratic club was sort of promoting campus activities, you know, or not in political as such, and sort of votes, that sort of thing, but just public interest. What are the issues, and what, you know? And we used to get cabinet members out constantly at the campus, you know, for sessions. And we'd have big crowds, right? We had students to come and hear the Secretary of Agriculture, Secretary of State, people, you know. But anyway, you know, that. Kind of got me into interest in politics, and by the time I graduated from college, no money in hand, whatever, been lucky to pay my bills, I decided to run for legislature.
Here?
And in those days, the legislature was in August, so I graduated in June, and next month I announced for office and was elected, and was elected four times. So I was chairman of the agriculture committee of the legislature, agriculture and agriculture and natural resources, and so I got a lot of good experience there. And of course, I come from College Park, and a lot of those days the agriculture industry was very deeply rooted there, because it didn't have a Department of Agriculture separate from the university. So a lot of my training, you know, came into my schooling. But anyway, after I was elected to the legislature, I realized that I liked it, but I also realized that I couldn't really do it the way it ought to be done unless I knew something more about the law. Laws, I need to know something about it. So I decided, I talked to the then Attorney General of the state, who had become a very close personal friend of mine, a fairly young man, much older than I was, but young years of politics then, by the name of Herbert O'Connor. He was later a United States Senator. But I used to have dinner with him at Annapolis in the evenings, you know, when the legislature was there in session. and talked to him a number of times about studying law. And he counseled me and said, told me how he would do it. And I did it. Went to school, University of Baltimore, five nights a week for 3 years, and carried on a job, earned a living, and attended legislative duties. So the job that I had for while I was in the legislature created a fair board, and I was asked to take the job as executive director of that. So I was the first director of, might say, the Maryland State Fair Board.
Oh, Maryland State Fair.
And then, of course, I got, after I graduated from law, I got into law sort of full time. But now I've been talking about things of myself, rather, gotten off on that subject, but rather than the history of the county and the things that I remember about it. Well, that would be helpful to somebody else.
Yeah, this is very interesting. This is just exactly what I want to hear about. Your family had a farm during this whole time?
Well, yes. Matter of fact, the family farm went from father and mother to mother, and then to a brother. And the brother stayed on the farm, and that's where my mother, her income came from. And although she lived in the city with my sister. And as I say, that farm was just recently sold to the Kleins. But I wasn't on it. I mean, I when I left the farm to go to college, that was all the farming I did. On that farm. And it wasn't until I guess it must have been in the late 40s that I bought the first farm, which was the Booth property on Route 22. It was in shambles and about ready to fall down, and I'd sort of gotten interested in preservation. And so I bought it and made the first restorations on it, and then I sold it to Dick Worthington. It was with the Aegis, you know, family. But then I bought one other farm up on up near Hickory, and it too was in shambles, and of course I made some profit on the Booth property, and I made some profit on this one, the second one I sold it. And the basic holdings in real estate that I have now came from earnings as well as some profitable sales and real estate of other farms. But I've never permitted myself to get involved in the actual farm operations until I came here and lived here and took a little time off to sort of, I came here in 1960 and to clear the land a little more than it had been cleared and get out old fence roads and things like that and design the fencing and some new buildings and completely redid the barns from cattle barns to horse barns. So that's sort of the agricultural turn of things. I am keenly interested in conservation. I might say the rather important event in the county here in terms of agriculture was the initiation of soil conservation work. Well, it came along at a time out of people in the Roosevelt administration who had advocated soil conservation nationwide, because during the late 20s, we'd gone through some terrible dust storms and whatnot, and there seemed to be a general decline in the fertility of land over the entire nation. For instance, a state like Virginia, who at one point in time, agriculturally, was just the best land, most productive land there was. But without lack of knowledge and how to treat the soils and that sort of thing, it got poor and land eroded and so forth. And actually, when I was in college, subsequent to that, when I got into soil conservation, that sort of thing, I discovered that Virginians were realizing the desperate state that they were in. And they too, like Marylanders, pitched in to try to find something. So I took an active part in that. I believed in it. And so when Soil Conservation Service
For
boys, young boys out of work and that sort of thing, they'd take them out and then teach them how to do some skills and that sort of thing. Well, they had a camp up here, I forget what they called those camps, but they had some of them working on farms, putting in practices on farms. A farmer would say, yes, you can come in and put some of your practices on my land, and such as strip cropping, and they had a number of them in those days.
What year is this about?
Well, this largely would have been in the late 30s, very late 30s. I would say, yes, it was that would be generally the period I'm speaking of. And I became interested in that, plus the fact, being in the legislature, I was quite familiar with all the legislative activity that was going in Washington and what was planned for Maryland. As a matter of fact, I introduced the Soil Conservation Act, which was a revolutionary type of legislation, into the Maryland legislature myself. Had several sponsors with me, but I introduced it, and I knew the sponsors at College Park, and of course the Attorney General's office and so forth, and I worked out problems between the Attorney General's office and the state, the Department of Agricultural people. And so I was a part of that, and when I had my free time, I would go around the countryside and take pictures of places that needed work done on it. And I developed quite a series of slides, color slides, you see, 35 millimeter.
In the 1930s?
Yeah, late 30s. And
you still have those slides?
Oh, I don't know whether there's any around or not. But when I was, I left most of them, I used them in the state fair board office, and a great many of them I left there. But then I got to the point where I was getting invitations to address farmers groups all over the state, which, you know, on soil conservation and resource management and that sort of thing. So I've always had a great interest in that, but that's a great, that was I was sort of an active part in that program, and I'm still active in it. I mean, my land is cultivated in accordance with the soil conservation recommendations. And I'm even going beyond that. As soon as I can, I'm going to get out of cultivated crops altogether and just use grass. I have about maybe 100 acres at the present time is being cultivated. I think I'll just discontinue that because it's better preserved in grass here, and even though this is not too hilly a land. At the same time, it's subject to quite a lot of erosion. Yeah. But I would say that development in the county has been a major contribution to agriculture. Now, looking at the history aspects of the county,
tell me what changes you've seen in the time that you've been here.
Well, during my lifetime, you'd have to speak, of course you went from horse and buggy days for transportation and horses on the farm to tractors and automobiles and trucks and so forth. And that has enabled people to get around more. And when you do that, then you sort of open up new avenues for people to develop a business, to have a farm away from their business, or you have, and all that you see's come into play. Used to be, for instance, the population of farmers were people who engaged in agriculture solely, and that was their business. If they had a son that went off to business, that's what he did. You know, he did. Not likely he could come back to the farm because he was too distant away, probably, unless he lived at home. And very little of that, you know, could be done because there wasn't any industry for him to go to. And in a great many ways, I often think as I travel through southern Pennsylvania and Lancaster County in the Amish country, the use of horses and the uses of in the sort of primitive, which seem to be primitive ways of a lot of handwork and that sort of thing. The Amish sort of deprived themselves of the best machinery and things that shorten the load and the burden. So agriculture was pretty much operated in that manner in my first recollection. But then, as I say, the machinery came in and it's all mechanized and it's a sort of a science. And the first thrashing machine, for instance, of thrashing grain, I remember it came to the farm, would come to the farms. And you would arrange to have them come on a given day, and then you would have a vast number of teams and men to load up the grain and haul it from the fields into where it was being thrashed, you know. And then the grain would be bagged up in bags, burlap bags, and tied and either stored or taken off to some place mill that would buy it. And then, of course, they probably would ship it to a storing facilities at some distant point by rail. But all of that's changed, you see, with the modern machinery. Because when the crop is ripe, well, you just go through it with a machine and thrash it right in the field and separate the grain from the straw, bale up the straw, and that's processed individually. So it's a whole new ball game. In those days, after the thrashing, you just had a big pile of straw. And if you did any baling to it, you'd have a separate device that came in, and that was a long and tedious job of moving all that straw by hand and getting it through a baling device, don't you know? So as a result, a great deal of straw stacks would just remain in the field until they were rotted up and then spread on the field for manure. But the vast change, the small community, those days was a small community where people had lived. If you had any land at all, you'd had a garden and a few chickens. And if you had a large enough place, you wasn't going to irritate your neighbors too much, you'd have a hog or two, you see, for meat. And your garden and that sort of thing, they were in a very large measure self-sufficient. And the things you could buy at a store in those days did not include fresh fruits and vegetables, that sort of thing, in the country. In the city, you could get some of that, but not here. And so the people lived a different kind of life. And then as time went on and has moved on, you could buy vegetables in the market frozen. You see, now cheaper than you can grow it yourself. You can get eggs fresher in the grocery store than you can raise your own eggs. You see, and the same thing with meat. So all that has gone out of the activities of people that lived in small communities and through the urban area. And so no one now, you know, involves in that at all. Some people like to have a little garden just to play with. And I, at one stage of my life, I lived in Bel Air, and I had a sizable lot back in the house, and I had a nice garden. I liked that. I was there about 4 or 5 years. But, so life has changed for people. And I noticed, particularly I think it's notable to with relation to young people. That kind of a household always had something for the children to do. If it was nothing more than to weed the garden for a few hours a day or a few minutes a day, and carry the wood into the house for the heat, if you were on large enough or parcel land, why, they may carry on a little more activities than that, you know. So that young people, when they went to school, when they came home from school, they didn't really have any problem about finding things to do. They were just there to do, you see. But I think that's one of the great problems you have with young people today. We haven't really found any substitute for the activities that children carried on. And of course the rural areas are now are all grown up with people that are not involved in that, could just got a house and lot. So when they come home from school, why, what is there to do? And so we just have not been, in this country, we just have not involved ourselves, I don't think, in planning enough for some kinds of activity for young people. Then we go further than that. Everybody's afraid that some youngster is going to hurt himself working. And so you have all kinds of laws against a child working. See, so what that does, that puts him out of business because nobody can hire him. And just this last week, one of the most active and promising boys I think I've had call on me for a job came in wanting to help me. And I put him to work, and he was with an adult at the time, and the adult recommended him. The adult said, look, you've got 3 loads of hay out there. Don't you need somebody to throw them on, get them in the barn? I said, yeah, of course. The adult had worked for me before. I said, yeah, I do, but I don't have any help. I said, how about us doing it? So he and his boy put 3 loads of hay in the barn in a couple of hours, and I watched that boy work. He's only 15. He was wringing wet from his shoulders down to his ankles from perspiration. And when he finished, he said, well, what are you going to do with that hay? You got to bale tomorrow. Or you're baling tonight. I said, I don't know. I don't know how I'm going to get that off. He said, how about we come over in the morning and unload it for you? I said, my God, that'd be a godsend. And he and that boy came back. Well, anyway, that boy went to work for me. He said, I want to work for you. Well, come over tomorrow, and one day we'll take a look, and maybe you could fit in, maybe you'll like it here. So he came over, and I put him in a barn, with a young girl that was sort of taking care of the stables, and God, he had never seen a horse stall before, but he wound up being unusually good. So I decided to hire him. And I've never hired any minors under the present laws. And I said to him, there are some laws against against child hiring children unless you have a permit. And I said, I understand you can get them from the Department of Education. He said, yeah. So that's where you get it. Well, I said, maybe you ought to get a permit. And so he said, well, I'll see my mother and we'll try to do it tomorrow. Well, when he went down to make application for the permit, they told him he could only work 20 hours a week, totally, and that all of these restrictions against the things he couldn't do and so forth, you see. And he came back and he said, I can't do that. He said, I can't work for you that way. I can just pick up some jobs around the community here and there. But he said, I couldn't work for you full time. So now what that does is just put him out of the job market. And here's a boy that really needs it. And I talked to his parents and grandparents, and they agreed. That's exactly what he needs, is something like this is responsibility. So that's changed, and for the worst. And there's no improvement in that. Now, it you do have to separate out the work on farms and odd jobs from factory labor and that sort of thing. But not to, and we used to have a distinction between farm labor and other kind of labor, but the distinction is not that great any longer. And you have all these civic organizations around the community, they don't have another thing to do except to just get themselves frothed up over some community problem that can just get their minds working on such things as child labor and things of that kind, and not know a thing about the subject, not know a thing about its impact, and to have actually affect the whole process of trying to get young people an opportunity to work. The young people today have no ability. They have no ability to work. Just none. And if you take them off in an office or something and train them for this process or that process, but to have any mind to handle a job, they don't. Well, anyway, that's changed, and of course, other things have gotten into it. Labor unions too. Labor unions haven't affected agriculture yet in this country very much. But now then, let me get to another subject. You mentioned that you wanted to sort of get sort of some statements relate to comparisons of the time, so as to relate it to the history of the county. I think one of the major things that I've seen and seen happen during my time has been the great increased output of education, and then the interruption of that with the bureaucracy, with labor unions, and with people who can't teach, but somebody has to hire them, and the loss of control of the parents over what happens in the schools, I think is the worst thing that's happened during my time. When I went in within the legislature, I became tremendously interested in education in all of its facets. And I used to be one of the prime supporters of budget and educational causes that was supported by the statewide organization of parent teachers. In those days, parents and teachers had one mind on education. And they were very effective. They were very effective with the legislatures, with the county governing bodies. They got great preferential treatment, built a lot of good schools. I can recall here, back in the 40s, early 40s, when we started to revise our system here, I had an active part in getting a new superintendent who had to replace the retiring superintendent, Milton Wright, who was a wonderful man, and he was the closest personal friend I had, I guess. But he and I knew that I didn't think the schools were looking to where they ought to be going and getting schools built where they ought to be and what kind of facilities we ought to have and so forth. And eventually he retired a little prematurely in order, and he had this wisdom, in order to allow the county to meet a situation and get on with redoing the school system, a job he at his age was not up to. And that's the kind of a man you had, the superintendent at that time. And so we got a new superintendent, and a lot of us counseled with him, and he appointed a study group, matter of fact, they paid a group out of, I think it was Boston College, but it was an outside group to come in and survey the county school system and make recommendations. And they did a wonderful job surveying the student population, where it was located, where it was projected to be in the future, what schools we now had, why they were misplaced, some of them, and what kind of school should be built. A wonderful report. And so when it got down, of course, to the bottom line, was the question of what was it going to cost the county to do it. I can't remember now whether it was 10 cents or 20 cents on the tax rate. In other words, the tax rate would be increased 10 cents on the dollar. Or $100, 10 cents on every $100, that it would produce enough money to restructure the whole school system and modernize it. Well, it was enough of supporting the county among the leaders and the parent teachers and so forth, and we went ahead and did that. And the county commissioners levied made the levy right just as soon as the report came out, almost, and or the first tax year thereafter, even though we hadn't built any buildings, hadn't done any planning, but they started to levy the money. And so no time until plans, you know, were in position to build the buildings, and new structures went up, and the centralization took place. We built one school for colored students, closed all the one-room schools, and brought them all to a wonderful school there. Wonderful colored school was it at Hickory.
And what year was this about?
Well, it was, I'd say that was in the early 40s, and
Mr. Wright, C. Milton Wright, had already retired at that time?
Well, he retired before that. We brought in a man by the name of Willis, Charles Willis. He'd been a principal out in, I think, Frederick, if I recall correctly. He was a wonderful organizer and put things together, wonderful with dollars and figures.
Can you tell me about Mr. Wright? Mr. Well,
Mr. Wright was an old family here, and he had been superintendent for many years. And
you said he was a close personal friend.
Well, he was a personal friend because during his last years, you know, in the legislature, I handled a lot of educational matters for them, you know, and I got we got to be very, very close friends, and he and I never had any problem not seeing eye to eye on most anything, you know. And but he was a wonderful man, and as a matter of fact, he wrote the book, you know, in the history of Harford County. And later, when I was he'd retired. And later, when I was judge of the People's Court, which is in the sort of the, I guess the, it would have been in the late 50s and 60s, and I was chief judge of the what was then the People's Court, we needed a sort of a probation officer. So he worked for the county as a probation officer, handling the cases of young people, young children, you know, school problems, things like that. So he was a wonderful contributor, a wonderful man. Well, another development that's been that I've seen during my time at. Most people have, of course, my age, is the change in the highway system. The roads were paved roads, hard macadam roads were didn't exist except where you had a major state routes when I was growing up in the 20s. And the roads that are now all paved and so forth were all dirt roads. And first, a lot of these roads were treated with gravel, what we call bank run gravel, which is a mixture of gravel and clay, that came out of the first district of the county, where we had a lot of gravel pits. And those were improved by sort of putting gravel down. Some of them were improved by sort of using some of the offfall from the slate quarries. But then there came a time when they were crushing stone rather efficiently, and the next stage was sort of crusher-run roads. And that material would stay in place pretty good, but it wouldn't last too long. It would wash some. And so then they begin to cover those crusher-run stone bases with asphalt. And first was what they used to call tar and chipping. They'd put down tar, and they'd put down then stone chips on top of that to make the take a hard base, but a weatherproof base. See, water would run off of that. And the tar, of course, was a sealer. Then, of course, still later came the what we know as the asphalt blacktop, which is a mixture of tar and stone and some clay in it to give it some flexibility. But when that's put down and rolled, of course, it makes it's a sealed surface, sealed road, and with a very smooth surface. So most of the counties and the roads now have been actually blacktopped, you see, and are all weather roads. Now that's a development that's taken place in the last 60 years. Now then, I don't know, is there any other...
Well, any other stories about living in Harford County that come to mind about your work here? And
well, of course, an awful lot of interesting things come to mind, you know.
Well, tell me about it.
But they're so highly personal, but
well.
The course, I tell you one thing that's changed a lot has been the political system and the election of people to office. I remember when I I mentioned when I was in college, I became quite interested in government. So when I graduated from college with a degree in animal sciences and agriculture at the University of Maryland, I had a sort of a general background in, well, generally what government was all about and how people were elected and so forth. But I would come to know that politics was just a minute, I'll get this from paper. You know, sort of the, let's say when I ran for office in 1934, of course the motor vehicle was pretty active and generally used at that time, and but it wasn't access to everybody. Radio was here, but television wasn't, and the media, as you now know it, didn't exist. The principal media was the radio. I mean the newspapers, rather, the management of those newspapers were in the hands of highly ethical and highly principled people.
Do you remember the paper's name specifically, Roger?
Well, of course, we had the Aegis here, and then we had the Baltimore Sun paper. We had the New Baltimore News, which was a Hearst paper. Those are the three principal papers that I would have been involved with. And of course, we had other papers here in the county too. We had an Aberdeen paper. I can't remember Wilma Cronin's paper's name. It was published there in Aberdeen. And then there was a Havergrass paper, Havergrass Record, I think. And they had an unusual position in the community, in that they were looked upon as sort of the guiding influences of civic life and what was good for the county and what was bad and so forth. But they weren't interested in all this drama and everything that's beat up, you know, in the daily press today and on television and so forth. But not that they wouldn't mention things that happened, but they wouldn't make the world's all-world affairs depend on them. And so the newspapers had a very big, great effect upon the elections. And they had a practice of endorsing candidates and analyzing candidates. Many times they would, and then they would very fairly analyze candidates and then give their reasons, you know, for the ones they got. But then in addition to that, there were in the county a great many people who followed those newspapers rather closely, probably contributed to a great deal of the material that was in them, because the local publisher would talk with a great many people that he felt had a good sound view. And so it was that around a election precinct, the people who really influenced generally how the vote came out were civic leaders, business leaders, and very few in number. There weren't many of those kinds of people, but they had a tremendous impact over how the people were, because the other people would, the general population, let us say, who didn't bother too much with the political thing, they would depend on him, and they would ask him, and they would have a tremendous impact upon the election. And I remember my first election, Major Archer had gotten his endorsement to run for legislature, and he kind of coached me some. But I remember he gave me a long list of people scattered all over the county that I was to go see, or should see. And he knew where they lived and so forth, you know. And a lot of them didn't agree with him politically. And then he would say, well, don't tell him I sent you, don't you see. But I was later to recognize that if you had that list of people in Harford County with you, endorsing you, see, locally, not publicly, but just locally, you couldn't lose an election. And it wasn't over 150 of them, you see. But they were all substantial people. And they were storekeepers and people like that, you know. But anyway, that has been a vast change from that. With the media now, an individual person in the community really doesn't have any influence anymore of any consequence at all. And about the most influence that anybody can have in an election today is put up some money for a candidate so he can go buy some time on television or radio or an ad for the paper. That's about the only way you can help him, see? So it's changed tremendously. And whereas the old system permitted the cities to, a few people in the cities to run the politics, in the counties it was a very good influence, you see, quite different. And so we've lost that. And I really don't have any opinions on that as to whether that's been good or bad, because the I do think the method of candidates raising money today, of raising money from people that they've got to accommodate when they go to the legislature, gets very close to just selling your vote. But it's going on in the Congress as well as here, and I think that it will change in time, because I think the public are getting very, very fed up with it. And matter of fact, the Congress understand that the people want to change there, and I think they're going to find some changes. But it's going to take time to do that. Here's a member of the legislature today who, and all of them do it, they'll hold themselves a fundraising breakfast or lunch or that sort of thing, and the principal people, they vote, are invited are those first that have money, but secondly have some legislative interest that they want to get some inside handle on, all of which is bad. And it has had some effect in shaping the not only the votes in the legislature, but the people in the legislature. And there's a lot of people now that really don't run for office because they don't want to be associated. They just don't think that's very attractive and just a little unpalatable to them, you know. And that's an unfortunate thing. Very unfortunate. When I was a young man and running for office was an honorable thing to do, you see. And it's changed quite a lot. The one other thing that I might mention that has taken place, there's been a tremendous interest in public ownership of land for parks and recreation facilities. There's been a tremendous increase in that. And as a matter of fact, there's been a tremendous increase in expenditure of money for parks and for open spaces. I've seen that development take place. The first parks that we developed here in the state, of any consequence, state parks, were developed out of land that was purchased at foreclosure proceedings in Western Maryland, primarily, during the Depression of the late 20s and 30s. Matter of fact, people couldn't even own hundreds of acres of forest land, and they cut the timber off it. They couldn't even pay the taxes until it came back to production again. So they just took up for tax sales and sold, and state bought thousands upon thousands of acres of it. And so they were public holdings, and then they were, we developed some of it as park land for public use, you know, for recreation. And then the thing began to spread over the state. And now it's pretty general. Practically every county has a big park system in it, you know, and recreation areas. In Harford County, we have the big Susquehanna Park, and the Rocks Park. All of these, I had a beautiful active part in trying to encourage it to promote it. Senator James was and I were great friends, and we served in the legislature together, and he served much after I left, and was president of the Senate for a number of terms. He and I used to just sit down like we are here this morning and talk about these problems, and then sort of make a judgment as to how's the best way to get something done about it, you know. Things like parks and historic preservation, those are things that we would work on. Harvard Community College, Bill James and I were the first two active promoters of Harvard Community College, and we just kind of beat together some supporters and we were one of the earliest colleges in the state. But it's something that people have to do. And I've always sort of found it interesting to do things. See what you do in a civic way can have a lot bigger influence on life around you than anything else, any other contribution you can make. If you can if you do things where people respond to it. Historic preservation is another thing that's taking place during my time. I got interested in the subject. I was asked to be one of the directors of the Hampton House over at Towson. And it's a government-owned, actually political. Some political force was kind of put into it, and it was purchased by federal funds, and then it's operated by private funds, and principally. And then I got to know some people in preservation, and then I could see that you couldn't do it with just contributions. You had to have some public monies, and I knew the governor at the time, and we got a committee appointed to study the matter of preservation in Maryland and what the state's responsibility was. I served on the committee, and we, matter of fact, wrote a report for it. We came up with a proposal that they set up a Maryland Historical Trust. And they wouldn't have any obligation for funding anything. Just if the trust did any work and made any proposals that were worthy of the legislature's financing, why, they could do that. But there wasn't any obligation. So that came into existence, and served on the first board of trustees for a number of years. We were able to fashion a program of direction. And it's interesting to see now so many people, you know, buying property and fixing them up and preserving them and so forth. An attitude that we didn't have in the 60s when we were, before we created the trust in 62, I think. But these are the kinds of things that I have to have some gratification in, my part in part, and I think it's still the most meaningful thing for all of us to do is to find ways to make contributions that put that impact a lot of people, you see, and get a lot of people interested in a cause. And but there's been a major thing that I've seen the development of the park system in the state. I was not in the legislature when Governor McKeldin was elected, and he was a great advocate of the outdoors. He was been mayor of Baltimore City for a number of years, and then he was governor. And he and I became great friends. And during his administration, I helped to fashion a program for the Gunpowder Park system. And the Tapsco Park system. All of those have come into existence during my time. And we have a large, the Gunpowder system reaches now all the way up to the Pretty Boy Dam, which is through Baltimore County.